see the map yet. I'm going to start talking about this map, and you guys aren't going to know what's going on. That wouldn't be the first time that I was talking about something and people didn't know what was going on, though. Yeah, that's a stock picture with windows. I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember. Okay, there it is. I got to remember how to put this up here. It's kind of nice. I can see a reflection of what you're seeing in the windows back there, so I can at least tell if I'm close. All right, so now you guys are seeing what I'm seeing. Okay. All righty. So last week we looked at a stolen hearts and a stolen kingdom as Absalom is executing his plan to take over the rule of Israel in a very seditious sort of way. He's not running against David in the primary elections. Obviously, they didn't have primary elections or even normal elections. David was king. God anointed him, and that's the way it was. So Absalom, in order to take over the kingdom, needs the support of a huge majority. So today we would call Absalom's action a coup. He's trying to oust the current government with military action. And so for several years now, he has been courting the people with accusations against David's leadership. And boy, we thought sometimes we have trouble with our children at home when they don't want to listen to us, right? But here's Absalom showing the greatest dishonoring of father and mother that he possibly could. He's trying to oust his father from the throne, which is going to necessarily mean that if he succeeds, he's going to have to kill his own dad, because that's the only way to secure the throne for himself. And apparently, Absalom's good with that. And so he's rallied these men, and he took a trip down to Hebron under the pretenses of having a sheep shearing party, which was a very normal course of events there. So there's a lot of names jumbled together right here. If you can see where this hand is, that's Jerusalem. And I can't draw on this one. Right here is Jerusalem. This is where David has the capital, and it's where the temple is at. So Absalom has gone down to Hebron, which is in the south. Down here, about 20 miles or so, this is a symbolic place, we said, because what else happened in Hebron? Gene? That's where David was king first over Judah. So that's a very symbolic thing for Absalom to go down to Hebron to start his rebellion. And so he went down to Hebron, and apparently he had the hearts of all the men of Israel with him. And so he goes down there, and he has spies sent into all the regions of Israel, and they are instructed to blow a trumpet and cry out, "Absalom is king in Hebron." And apparently up to this point, he's got the support of most of the people. That's where we pick up in verse 13 as we begin to look at David's second exile. David has been king now for probably about 30 years. How long did David's reign go total? 40. Yeah, about 40 and a half years. He's 7.5 years at Hebron, and then 33 years in Jerusalem. David's total reign, therefore, is a little over 40 years. If we do all the math, we can put together some reasonable timelines. There's nothing that tells us definitively when all these events take place, but we can put together some reasonable limits as to when all this is happening. So David becomes king in Hebron, and it's during those 7 years that four children are born to him, and one of those is Absalom. The first is Amnon, the second is Kileab, who probably dies young, the third is Absalom. They're all born in Hebron. Amnon is dead. His brother Absalom killed him. So that means Absalom is next in line for the throne. Except there was another person that we have a statement about. If you go back a couple of chapters to right after, I'm in 2 Samuel. If you go back to chapter 12, we have a little statement that's out of narrative, meaning that it's not within the normal flow of the narrative, but it gives us a detail that we need to know. Chapter 12, verse 24, "Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, went in to her and lay with her, and she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. And the Lord loved him." The Lord loved him. That's going to be an important note. Well, going back to our timeline here, Absalom is born sometime in the 7 years that David is at Hebron. So if we do a little bit of simple math, David reigns 40 years. That means Absalom at this point, at the rebellion, cannot be more than 40 years old, right? That's an absolute limit. So Absalom can't be more than 40 years old. We also know there are a couple of events in David's life that have to take place after Absalom's rebellion. So we need a couple of years at the end for those things to happen. David starts amassing material for the temple. We have David's numbering of the people. We have the plague that comes after that. We even have some other things going on there. So we need a couple of years at the end of his reign, which means Absalom really can't be more than about 35 or 36 when this happens. However, we also know he's not the firstborn son, so we need a year or two padding at the beginning. So Absalom, at the most, is probably in his early 30s when all this is going on. And of course, then we can put together, we know that he was hiding with his grandfather for several years in, I'm just drawing an absolute blank on the name of the kingdom, up there by the Sea of Galilee. And we know that he was plotting to kill his brother for 2 years. So we can put all those things together and say, Absalom's probably in his early 20s when Tamar is raped. And the events of his murdering Amnon and fleeing to Geshur and then coming back to Jerusalem and being exiled from the royal court for a couple of years take place in his mid to late 20s, right? So we are at this point probably 34, 35 years into David's reign, which means we're getting close to the end of David's life. How old was David when he became king? Nope. This is a tidbit that we do know. He was 30 when he became king, and he reigned 40 years, which means he dies when he's 70. And which also means that given all that other detailed information, that we know that this rebellion of Absalom is happening sometime around the point when David is between 60 and 65 years old. Okay? So he's not the middle 20s warrior that he was when he was exiled from Saul. He's not the young man that he used to be, and now he finds himself in this position. Go back to chapter 15. Verse 13, "A messenger came to David saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom.'" That little discouraging report comes to David and forebodes a lot of trouble. Because, as we've said, you don't have a military coup in the ancient Near East without killing the king and his counselors and most of the royal family. It just didn't happen. They didn't have all that many peaceful transitions of leadership. So, you know, it's one of the things that's so amazing about our country was that when George Washington was done and said he was retiring after 2 terms as president, the whole country was on edge for a while. Is this going to transition peacefully, or are we going to explode again? Because countries don't normally have peaceful transitions of leadership. And yet, ever since the founding of our country under our Constitution, we've had peaceful transitions for 200 plus years. And it's been an amazing thing. It's huge, the amount of prosperity that peace brings, because then you're not spending all your money on war. All right. Well, this is what's going to happen. When David finds out that the men of Israel are with Absalom, now he knows he's got a big problem. All right, so here's what he's going to do. Verse 14, "Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, 'Arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword.'" So here is David. He hears the news, and he's formulating a plan pretty quickly. And he says, we've only got one option, and that is we've got to skedaddle. We've got to get out of here. Now, again, Hebron is only a day's march from Jerusalem. You can get there if you've got an army and you push them pretty good. You can get there in a day. So by the time the messenger gets to David and says, hey, Absalom's blowing the horn, he's proclaiming himself king, you don't have much time, David. And Absalom's got a big crowd of people with him. So David says, I've got one option. And he's got a couple of concerns. Excuse me. The first of them, when he says, let us get out of here, is he says, if we don't get out now, if we don't flee, there will be no escape for us. So he says his first concern is, we don't want to get trapped inside the city. Cities are great to protect you, but if you are trapped inside a city, you have to be able to outlast the bad guy, which means you got to have more food than him, and you got to be able to repel any attacks. Well, David doesn't have enough men to man the walls. He doesn't have enough of an army with him at present time to defend the city from a prolonged siege. And on top of that, if the hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom, how many of those hearts are in Jerusalem? You don't know, do you? You don't know who's on your side, who's not on your side. I mean, can you imagine that kind of a civil war where you're not sure which side everybody's on? It's going to be a tough thing. And so he says, we've only got one option. If we are going to escape, we got to get out now. Otherwise, we're going to be trapped inside this city. But he's also got a concern for the city. And he says, go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. David doesn't want to see Jerusalem destroyed. Why might David not want to see Jerusalem destroyed? There's actually a lot of reasons. You can pick one. He loves it. He loves the city. He spent a lot of time building the city, hasn't he? From the time he took it from the Jebusites, about 30 years before this, he's been working on the city, building its defenses, building its storehouses, making it more defensible. What else is there? He's brought the ark there. The temple doesn't exist yet, but he does have a tent in Jerusalem where the ark dwells. That's going to come in a little bit later. But David's one of the ones that writes for us several of the Psalms about Jerusalem being a place that God loves. David knows God loves this city. And so he doesn't want to see the city completely destroyed by Absalom's rage. And so he says, we got to get out of here or they're going to be able to destroy us. And so his servants, seeing this one option, verse 15, said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord decides. This is all of David's household servants, his family, his military commanders. They're all saying, we're with you, David, whatever you want to do. If you want to stay here and fight, we'll stay and fight with you. You want to run for a little while until we can gather more forces, then let's go. We're with you. Either way you go. Now this is loyalty. This is these people showing their devout devotion to David. It's a pretty big thing. It probably was encouraging for David to have that, and he needs some encouragement. Because how many of us would be able to stand up if they said, you know what, Ethan's coming. He's looking at me like, why do I always get picked on? What? So, we're ready to go with you wherever you decide. Verse 16, so the king went out and all his household after him. What did David leave with in his first exile? When he fled from Saul, what did he take with him? Nothing. Clothes on his back. He didn't even have time to grab a sword. He had to stop at the city of Nob and ask Ahimelech the priest for weapons and for food. He had a few people following him, but that wasn't much. Until he got to the strongholds in the south of Judah, he didn't have many people with him. And then people started gathering to him. But this time he leaves, he's going into exile with his whole family. And we know from some of the lists that were left to us that David married several women. He's got a lot of children, and he's got to bring them all with him. At this point, Solomon is probably 9, maybe 10 years old. We know Solomon's a young man when he begins to reign. He's one of the few kings that we're not told how old he is when he starts to be king. Solomon, like his father, reigns for 40 years, but we don't know how old he was when he started, and we don't know how old he was when he died. For some reason, God didn't think we needed to know that. And so we know David. starts reigning at 30 years old, reigns for 40 years, and we know that Solomon is a very young man. So he might be in his late teens when he begins to reign as king. Again, we can put some limits on things and say that probably his affair with Bathsheba didn't happen until about 20 years into David's rule, so that makes probably 20 years old an upper limit for Solomon's age when he becomes king. Which means that at this point, at the most, Solomon's 13. So what happens to Solomon if Absalom overtakes them? Yeah, he's dead. You can guarantee that Absalom is not going to let David's favored son survive. Nor any of David's sons. Absalom will make sure that he's the only one left to claim the throne. And so David and all his household went after him, and the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. Now you can thank your lucky stars you're not one of these poor ladies. Sometimes God tolerates our bad thinking, doesn't he? And he tolerates our bad action, and here is one of those cultural expressions that God put up with for a very long time, was that concubines were counted as little more than a piece of property in the royal harem. And so David just leaves them to take the house and fend for themselves. So they've got to sweep the floors and keep everything clean while Absalom comes in and wreaks havoc on everything. So David leaves these 10. Why did he leave these 10? Probably because they were the lowest on the totem pole. He takes all of his actual wives with him, takes any of the favored concubines with him. But these 10, he just leaves them there to fend for themselves. All right. So he left them to keep the house. Verse 17, the king went out and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house. So here begins this parade, and it's not a joyful one, though. You know, we get parades on the 4th of July, and here at Corn Festival and things, and we'll have fun parades, and we like to go because they throw out candy, and you ought to see Kim just knocking down little kids. I'm just teasing. But we love those parades. This is not an exciting kind of parade because it's a parade of defeat. It's a parade of despair. And yet, on the other hand, it's a parade of supporters for David. Though it's mournful, it's got to be a little bit encouraging for David to see how many people are with him. And we're going to see just how many are with him as he goes here. Of course, first of all, he's got his own household. So all of his wives, his sons, his household servants that are loyal to him, they're all going out with him. Verse 18, and all his servants passed by him, and all the Kerethites and all the Pelethites. These are mentioned several times in Scripture. Our best guess as to what they are is that they're bodyguards of different sorts, and that these men were fiercely loyal to David and would have accompanied him on all the battles. They would have been the royal entourage, so when David went out, he was highly protected in any situation. And so they're very, very loyal to David. So they're going out with him. We don't have a number of them, but notice this next little tidbit that the chronicler gives us. All the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath. Where's Gath? Yeah, it's over there on the west side of your map. To what country does Gath belong? Or, I should say, did it belong? Philistia. It was a Philistine city. Who lived in the Philistine city of Gath? Philistines. Yeah, Philistines. How did David and the Philistines normally get along? They didn't. But there is, we reviewed this detail back in chapter 8, verse 1. We have a note that David conquered the city of Gath from the Philistines, and he took it from them. And you can reference that also in 1 Chronicles 18, 1. So we know that David took direct control of Gath. Now, when David conquered some of the other towns and countries around Israel, he would put them into a subservient position, but they would be allowed to administer the country their own way as long as they were sending tribute to David. All right, it's what was called a suzerain vassal relationship. And so King David would be considered the greatest of the kings, and then the king of the Moabites, he would still be king of the Moabites, but he had better send in tribute money to David every year. And then if David had any particular laws he wanted the Moabites to implement, they would have to. And sometimes it involved sending in forced labor. Sometimes it involved contributing troops to the military. But it always involved money. So that was the normal relationship, a suzerain vassal. But we read there in chapter 8, verse 1, that David actually conquered Gath and took it from the Philistines. And so Gath, at this point, belongs to Israel, but it's probably still populated by Philistines. But in this crazy turn of events, here's David. He's being kicked out of his own capital because his son is chasing him out. And there's 600 men from Philistia that are following David. Now, you'd think they'd be happy to see David kicked out of Jerusalem. But these guys are loyal to him. This is one of those instances in Scripture I say, boy, I wish we had more information on these guys. Because that's a pretty intriguing concept to me. But these 600 men who followed him from Gath, they passed on before the king. And then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. So there's a clue that they're not Israelites, right? These guys had come to Jerusalem to support David. They must have recognized God's stamp of approval upon David, and they forsook their own country, they forsook the allegiance to their king, and they came to Jerusalem to serve David. Now David tells them, stay here. This isn't your fight. You're not part of this. You're not an Israelite. You're an exile. So just stay here and you'll be safer. Because Absalom probably won't exact any vengeance on you guys. He'll just want you to fight against me. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us? Since I go, I know not where. Go back and take your brothers with you. May the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. So David's advice to these Gittites, just go home. This isn't your fight. This doesn't have anything to do with you. I love the response that comes out of them. This is Ittai speaking for all of them. Verse 21, as the Lord lives and as my Lord the King lives, wherever my Lord the King shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be. This is what amounts to an oath of allegiance. David, we're your men. Wherever you go, we're going. You know you've got a standing army of at least 600 men at all times. I mean, that must have been an encouraging thing for David. Here, your own countrymen have turned against you almost completely. But these 600 foreigners, what do they recognize about him? And you notice the oath that they swear. By whom do they swear it? As the Lord lives. You notice who they're not swearing by? What's the Philistine god's name? Dagon? Remember him? Remember when the ark dwelt in his temple? What did Dagon do? He lost his hands and his head, yeah. Lost his head. Fell flat on his face, had to bow before the might of Jehovah. Maybe that had something to do with these guys. I mean, that was quite a long time ago. That was 120 years before this. But maybe they heard about that. Whatever it is, they recognize the greatness of David and of David's God, and they swear an allegiance. David, we're your men. We're with you. I had a story one time of Robert the Bruce, claimant for the throne of Scotland when Scotland was fighting its wars of independence with Edward Longshanks, King of England. Edward Longshanks wanted to make Scotland subservient to England. It wasn't always the United Kingdom, right? Scotland is its own people. Even today you go there, there are very different people than the English and the British, right? Just like Ireland is very different. You must know something about that, Wayne. So, you know, the Irish people are very different in culture and attitude and thinking from the Briton people. But when Edward Longshanks was trying to make Scotland subservient, fought many campaigns up there, at one point, Robert the Bruce found himself wandering through the countryside with nobody left. All his men had been defeated, and he himself had nothing left but the sword at his side. and he stopped at a humble little cottage and knocked on the door to ask for a place to stay. The Super 8 must have been closed for the night. That or they wouldn't take cash. And he didn't have any anyway, so he knocks on the door of this poor woman's cottage, and she opens the door, and he says, "Can I stay here?" And she said to him, "No one is allowed to stay here except for the men of Robert the Bruce." And he said, "Woman, I'm he." And she looked at him, and she kind of looked around, and she said, "Where's all your men?" And he says, I've been defeated. They've all forsaken me." She said, "I've got two sons. They're yours." And her two sons took up the call for freedom in Scotland. And they went to serve with Robert the Bruce. And it wasn't long before that, before he won independence for Scotland. For the next 300-400 years, Scotland was free. We usually think of England as our ally, but we got to understand that England has not always been the great free country that it is now. For a long time, it was a place of tyranny. And so Robert the Bruce, at that one point, was without a man to help him. And, you know, often I think God, when he's leading us through difficult things, will make sure that we have people to help us and support us. And that's what he's doing with David here. 600 men, they're yours. God hands David these 600 guys. Foreigners, once mortal enemies. I mean, David, after all, became famous and won the hearts of the people of Israel by slaying the Philistine champion Goliath, and by conquering 200 of them as a bride price for his first wife. So David was not normally beloved by the people of Philistia, but here's these 600 that have just sworn an oath of allegiance to him. So David accepts their help in verse 22. David said to Ittai, "Go then, pass on." So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. These guys didn't come to Israel for a vacation. They didn't come just in search of a job. They brought their whole families with them. They completely emigrated into Israel to live in Jerusalem with their whole families, and now they recognize their whole family's on the line. They've sworn this oath of allegiance to David, and now they know they and their families have to run with him or they'll be subject to Absalom's rage. And so David is standing at the edge of the city, and he's watching all his servants pass by, and his household goes on first so that they'll be protected, and then all of his servants and his personal bodyguards, and then come these 600 men of Gath with all of their servants and all of their little ones. And they're marching along in this procession with David. But I think it also shows a little bit about the trouble that David's in, because here he's got an army. How many people were with him in the strongholds of Judah? About 600. And in those instances, what happened when someone came and said, Ziklag's under attack? He went and fought him. He had 600 men that he knew were well trained. Here he's got 600 men he knows are probably pretty well trained, especially the Kelethites and the Pelethites. But it shows you the trouble that David knows he's in, that with this army of people, he still knows he's got to run. He can't stand and fight. So he knows that there's more people with Absalom than there are with him. And even though he fought off tremendous odds with his force of merry men down in the southern parts of Judah earlier in his life, he knows that these 600 guys don't stand a chance against what Absalom is bringing. And so they all pass by. And then the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. So the Kidron is a brook that runs down right beside Jerusalem. And it's down at the valley, so you have Jerusalem up here on a mountain. You go down into the valley, you have the Kidron Brook running down there, and then you head up the other side towards the Mount of Olives. Or at least that's what it'll be called in about 1,000 years. Mount Olivet. And so they're coming up over that hill, and they come up to the top of that hill. And there's somebody else coming with them as they're taking this parade. As they go over the top of that hill, they cross over all of it and down to the other side. They're going to lose sight of Jerusalem, and that's the last chance David will see it. So that's going to be a pretty discouraging moment for him as he leaves the sight of the city. Verse 24, "And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok came also with all the Levites, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the ark of God until all the people had passed out of the city. So here, this would have been a normal procession. We've read several times now that the ark went out with the people to battle, a symbol of God's presence. And so Abiathar and Zadok, who are serving as co-high priests at this point, just figure, hey, the presence of God needs to go with the rightful king, so let's go. They pull the ark out of the tabernacle. They march it out of the city with David, and they're standing there with David as all these people pass by. Very symbolic that God is with David. God's not with Absalom, because he's coming to attack this holy city. So they watch this whole parade go on, and then David does something kind of unexpected. You might think he really could use the ark of God with him, but he says just the opposite in verse 25. Then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. I mean, just that right there, imagine how that might make all the troops feel at this point. See, you want God to go back into the city? You don't want him with us? Of course, David had a greater view of God than that. It's not like he was envisioning God only being present on that ark. But it was very symbolic to have the ark with them. And so when David says, send it back, this is also very, very symbolic. But notice what he says about it. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. So what's the dwelling place? Jerusalem. Specifically the tabernacle, but the city as a whole, considered the dwelling place of God. I think David recognizes that this whole event in his life is a matter of discipline. That God is chastising him for his failures in his life. That the failure with Bathsheba and Uriah, the failure with his sons, not training them up to love the Lord, all of those things are culminating in this event in his life. And I think he's really coming to the point of questioning whether or not God is going to allow him to continue as the king. Now, the first time he fled, his first exile, we said, number one, he was young, he was stronger. Hey, you're 22 years old, you're adventurous. You don't mind sleeping under the stars for a little while, right? But as time goes on, that bed starts to feel nice and comfy. And I've noticed the transition that it's just not as fun to sleep in the living room anymore on that hard floor. Because you wake up in the morning, and methinks my body doth protest too much. So David's not looking for the adventure as much as he had been. But when he left being pursued by Saul, he had a very important promise with him. Because when he was young, Samuel had come along, poured a bottle of oil upon his head, and said, God's anointed you to be king over Israel. And David reasoned, God always keeps his promises, therefore I will be king at some point. So in all of my being chased around the wilderness, God's not going to allow me to be destroyed, I will at some point be king. That promise has been fulfilled. What promise has David got to hang on to now? That the Lord will not allow him to be destroyed by this. Is there still a son of David that can sit on the throne and fulfill the Davidic covenant? It's hard for us to imagine that it might be Absalom, but it could be, right? It could be a wicked son, and he could be disciplined. Peter, can I have your shoe? So David is leaving Jerusalem, not only having his son chase, being the one to chase him, and in the discouragement of knowing that he's lost the confidence of all the people of Israel, but he's not even sure that he has God's confidence at this point. And so he expresses this great if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back, and he'll let me see both it and his dwelling place. So David's saying, if I pass the test here, if I endure this chastisement successfully, then God might bring me back. But it's by no means a certain thing in David's mind. You can see just how discouraged he is. Verse 26, but if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him. We just sang that this morning. And we sang that in a song this evening as well. Blessed be your name. And how many of us really say, blessed be your name, both in the good times and the bad times? Usually the bad times we're saying something like, why me? But here David's expressing that same sort of reservation to God's sovereignty that Job did. That song we sung is taken from. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Whatever he gives me. And sure, we're good to say that when everything's doing great. $1 million arrived in the mail. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Next day, the tax bill for that $1 million comes in. It's $1.4 million in taxes. We still say, blessed be the name of the Lord. That's the challenge throughout our lives. And here David is, and he's discouraged, he's sad, but he's living up to a very righteous faith. Whatever God wants to do to me, he can do. Verse 27, however, David also has another idea in mind that's going to help him out in this military coup. He knows that Zadok and Abiathar are loyal to him and not to Absalom, and so he's going to plant some spies in the city. And it's not just going to be these two. We'll see here in just a few moments. But verse 27, the king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? That's the old word for a prophet. So David says, I know that you're a prophet. God has spoken through you, and that I'm going to need. So stay in Jerusalem. In case God sends any messages, go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. Excuse me. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So I want you to stay in Jerusalem, and if you hear anything from the Lord, send it to me right away, because I'm going to need to know that. But I need you in Jerusalem. I need you performing the services at the temple. I need you staying consecrated to the Lord so that if God sends any message through you, it'll be able to be delivered to me by your sons. The fords of the wilderness that he mentioned here on our map are the passing of the Jordan River right over here in this valley by Jericho is the place where the Jordan River can somewhat be forded, all right? And so once you pass over this, you enter into this wilderness area to the east. And so that's what David is talking about at the passage of the wilderness. So he says, I'm going to go there and I'm going to wait there for a little while until I hear from you. And so he's planting Zadok and Abiathar both and their sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, as spies, as it were, in Jerusalem to help him in his quest to return the throne. Verse 29, so Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. Verse 30, but David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered. Why barefoot and with his head covered? It's a sign of mourning. It's a sign of deep grief. We're not nearly this expressive anymore. We tend to try and internalize all of our emotions, and we don't like to let people see how we're feeling. I'm not always convinced it's a great practice. Because here David's in great grief, and so he's walking around with his shoes torn off, and he's walking around with his head covered. And if you ever see, even today, the Jewish people expressing their grief when someone dies, it's soul-stirring. To hear the cry they yell out, because they're not afraid to let out a shriek of grief, throwing dust up in the air and tearing. They actually do. They'll grab their shirt and they'll tear it. And it's a very, very visible sign of extreme distress. So David's weeping as he went, barefoot. We don't like to weep, do we, guys? Nah, if you're real tough and manly, nothing makes you cry, but I'll tell you what. When old Yeller gets shot, that's a hard scene, isn't it? I can't take movies like that anymore. They used to not move me, but you know, when we see movies where there's a death involved, it starts to get me anymore. Of course, I got to hide it from Kim's. I got something in my eye here. And then she gets me a Kleenex, right? And she says, yeah, you'll want to wipe that thing out of your eye. Yeah, we tough guys don't weep. Well, here's David, this mighty warrior, and he's crying as he went. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. This detail we noted back in chapter 15, verse 12. It was specific to point out to us that Ahithophel went to Hebron with Absalom. it's an interesting fact. And I didn't realize this until I started doing some looking on Ahithophel. Occasionally, I have the gumption to go through and look up some of these names. But when he hears that Ahithophel is with Absalom, that's a bad thing. Because back in chapter 15, verse 12, we're told that Ahithophel was David's counselor. So this is somebody that had been very trusted by David. This is somebody that was very close to him, would have helped David make all of the major decisions of the affairs of state. And now he's with Absalom. Do you feel the stab in the back from that one? But let's look into why Ahithophel is with him. All right? This is the first time in chapter 15, this is the first time Ahithophel's name has come up. But I want you to turn to chapter 23, 2 Samuel chapter 23. This is a list of all of David's counselors and mighty men. Why didn't I write down the verse? There it is, verse 34. We're looking at David's mighty men. And in verse 34, it says, Eliphelet, the son of Ahashbai of Maacah, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel of Gilo. Does that name sound familiar? This is one of David's 30 mighty men. These were David's closest military counselors. You know who else is in this list? Right down in verse 39. Uriah the Hittite? Interesting, isn't it, that when David committed adultery, it was with the wife of one of his 30 most trusted men. Now, the name that's mentioned here is Eliam, so we start to put together some pieces. Eliam is the son of Ahithophel, and Eliam is one of David's 30 mighty men. And Eliam's dad is Ahithophel. And Eliam's dad is Ahithophel. So we've got Ahithophel and Eliam that were both very close men to David. And now Ahithophel's with Absalom. But there's one more piece of information I want to put in there for you. So turn back to chapter 11. This is why you don't just count out all those lists of names and think that they're unimportant. Okay? 1 Chronicles 1 through 10. All those names are hard to pronounce, but they're important. So look at verse 3. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 3. David sent and inquired about the woman, and one of them said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah?" Are you starting to put this picture together? Ahithophel is Bathsheba's granddad. Eliam is Ahithophel's son. He's one of David's mighty men. Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba's husband, was also one of David's mighty men. And David committed adultery with her, had Uriah murdered. Uriah's the son-in-law of Eliam. He's the, I guess you would call it, the grandson-in-law of Ahithophel. Do you think maybe Ahithophel has got a grudge against David? Sees an opportunity to exact a little bit of vengeance on David for what he did to Bathsheba and to Uriah. But there's the family connections that are. Ahithophel is Bathsheba's granddad. You think, this is just my sanctified imagination working, so I may be right, I may not be right, but I wonder if there's a little bit of thinking in Ahithophel's mind that not no way, not no how, is the product of Bathsheba's adulterous relationship with David going to sit on the throne. Even though Solomon was born several years later, Ahithophel might be thinking, no way am I going to let this. I mean, he might be mad at Bathsheba too for doing what he did or doing what she did. But there's some of those connections that are going on there. So you see, these are not all divorced names that are completely separate from each other. These people related, they knew each other. David knew Bathsheba. When she was pointed out who it was, he knew who she was. Okay. So, there's Ahithophel. So you can understand then why it is such a shock to David that Ahithophel is among the counselors with Absalom in chapter 15. So, all right, we'll jump back to chapter 15, verse 31. It was told David Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. David does the only thing he knows to do here, offers up a prayer, "O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." Ahithophel's counsel must have been something greatly valued, greatly respected, and greatly, lost the word, workable, pragmatic. When he gave an opinion, it worked. We'll put it that way. And so David knows if Ahithophel's siding with Absalom, that's bad news for me. And so he prays, "Lord, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." So when David utters this prayer, here's what I find fascinating, verse 32. So he wants Ahithophel's counsel to be turned into foolishness. Verse 32, while David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, this is not the tabernacle, by the way. The top of mountains, there was often what was called a high place where God was worshipped. All throughout the history of Israel, they did not confine their worship to the tabernacle the way they were supposed to. So there's always lots of fun when you consult all archaeological things. They'll say, "Well, you know, it wasn't actually the way the Old Testament said. Here's this and here's this." And so we know that the Israelites didn't do things the way God told them to. The whole time they were in Israel, they didn't. That's why they got kicked out of the land. They didn't obey the law. And so at the top of the mountain, the Mount of Olives, there was a high place where God was worshipped. So they would offer sacrifices and incense there, even though they weren't supposed to. But they did. And so they come up to that point, and behold, you notice that word? Behold, what do we say behold means? Pay attention. Take notice of this. David just prayed, "Lord, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." Now behold, that's going to connect these two ideas. Look who shows up. Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. There's that great expression of grief again. Verse 33, David said to him, "If you go with me," and I can kind of see the wheels in David's head spinning. He sees Hushai. He knows who he is. Hushai's another good counselor. And he says, wait a second. I'm getting an idea. Hushai, if you go with me, you're going to be a burden. Whatever reason that was, David's got 600 plus men with him. What's one more? I don't know. But he says, if you go with me, it's going to be burdensome. Maybe Hushai is a very elderly man and he has trouble walking and it would be hard for David to bring him along. But he says, if you go with me, you'll be a burden. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. So you tell Absalom you're actually with him, then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. It's perfect. So David sees this plan coming together in his own mind as he's just prayed, Lord, I need help against Ahithophel, turn his counsel into foolishness, and then along comes Hushai the Archite. And David says, ah, perfect. Somebody that can go and can counter Ahithophel's counsel. So go in there, tell Absalom you're on his side, and when he asks advice, you give him bad advice. So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Remember David put them there as spies? And tell them, and by them you shall send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, not only are you going to frustrate Ahithophel's counsel, but you're going to spy on him for me so that I know everything that's going on in the royal councils. This is David trying to plant a Robert Snowden in the Israelite war council, all right? Publish everything that you can get your hands on. Verse 37, so Hushai, David's friend. Boy, David needs some friends right now, doesn't he? You have any friends that would go into this kind of danger for you? You run into these kind of friends once in a lifetime. Here this guy's willing to go in and play the spy for David. And what happens if he gets found out? It won't go well for him, will it? But he loves David and he's willing to do it. David's friend came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. So there we get this picture that David is exiting the city and he's cresting over the Mount of Olives just as Absalom is coming into the other side of Jerusalem. You remember the narrow escape around the mountains where Saul was going around one side and David was going around the other? And the only thing that saved David was that Saul heard the Philistines had invaded. Well, here David escapes narrowly once again. So it's just as he's cresting out of view of the city, Absalom's coming into the city. And David has entered the second exile of his life. We'll get into chapter 16 next week. And the events of this whole narrative will just keep continuing to unfold. Any questions?